Well, welcome everybody. I hope you guys are doing great. Thank you for the follow-up, the feedback, the answers to the questions you've sent by email. I welcome anything that we don't have time to discuss, any questions or comments. So thanks very much. In response to a couple of questions, I want to highlight something in the handout that you have that includes work pages and exercises after the outline of each of the seminars. The outline is fairly annotated, so you don't have to take a bunch of notes. But I want to highlight a couple of things especially. One is the needs and ideals. I would suggest if you have time, do that quiz and the preface for it, the explanation, and look at your top three needs and your top three ideals. That can be helpful. I usually ask most of the clients that I work with in mentor coaching to do that simple exercise so that we both have a clear idea of their needs and their ideals that can guide us in collaborating to construct plans and incorporate into the strategy and goals that they have. And when that happens, all of them is going in the same direction. You'll notice ideals has a lot to do with core identity, and needs has more to do with a sense of fulfillment and purpose, and they kind of combine to help orient to a client's compass, their North Star, so that all of them can be aligned. A couple of other things that you may find helpful. One is success insurance for completing goals. That's based on some research in executive mentor coaching. And look also at the transition story. And that's something I concocted just to look at one way of thinking about the kind of transitions you guys have made to become a professional coach. And each of our clients go through change and transition, as we've already discussed. So any other things you'd like to add to the hopper about what you'd like to have discussed or things you want to highlight that you want to be sure we incorporate in the discussion in our remaining time? Well, I welcome any questions or additions at any point, and you always can do that by email, and I will incorporate a discussion of what I hear you want to do that, and it does make a difference. I'll work that in to the discussions and probably stick mostly to the outline, but I welcome anything that you want to add or ask or challenges that you have, and we'll have just a bit of discussion, especially at the beginning of each of the seminars. So unless I hear otherwise, I'm going to put us on lecture mode. Okay, hold on. You see from the outline that we're going to talk about how to change mind, brain, and behavior. And I think this is one of the things that as mentor coaches that can make our work very, very impactful, because knowing how our minds and brains work can be a major facilitator in doing what we do and how we can really be a better catalyst for our clients' change. Just one brief story, or question rather, from one of your questions. How can you get someone to change? That's a great, simple question. Well, here's an answer from a few centuries ago. Blaise Pascal, French mathematician and philosopher, in the 1600s, already knew the answer. He said, people are generally better persuaded by the reasons which they have themselves discovered than by those which have come into the minds of others. So Pascal's answer was simple. Don't tell them to change. Don't tell them information or data. We know in neuroscience that that's not a way to change someone's mind. And evoke the reasons for change that are already in your client's mind and brain to support those. This is what motivated people to make a shift without resistance. So how do we do that? Well, we ask open-ended questions. We resonate empathically with someone's experience. We develop reflective listening together. And we also even summarize and respond with open-ended questions. This is the antithesis of facts, information, directives, suggestions. That way, there's nothing to oppose. There's nothing for their brain to seek to either agree and seek confirmation for, or refute and oppose and get more entrenched in their original position. So empathic resonance is to engage the experience of the other person and reflect our best sense of what we can imagine is in the foreground of that experience for the client. This establishes the collaborative framework. So let's look, I'm going back to the outline now that you have. So why do we resist change? Even changing a story that doesn't work. What keeps people from doing what they know they need to do for themselves? Why will they repeat behavior that doesn't work, often doing it harder, and still expect a different result, even when it may lead to lower energy or debt or plateaued careers or disappointing relationships? Nassim Taleb asks in his book, The Black Swan, what are our minds made for? It looks like we have the wrong user's manual. So part of the answer to why we resist change is in our minds. We repeat the same story because it's our comfort zone. It's secure and predictable. It's our default mode that operates automatically. A comfort zone can be limiting or even uncomfortable, but it's familiar. It's become the default model. We repeat and our brain hardwires it so we don't have to think about it. And we repeat because we know how it's going to turn out. That can create the illusion of effectiveness instead of simply repetition. Now, a new story, which is exactly what you're doing with every client to break the script, to get them to think about something in a new or different way, or just question what they're doing. A new story generates uncertainty, trepidation. The easiest and fastest way to end this discomfort for the client is to go back to the familiar, the old story, or foreclose it with a reason that it makes sense to continue doing what they're doing. People fail to change because they don't feel safe or comfortable changing. It means even leaving their home base of reality, an internal map that's synonymous with identity. We tend to return to our default mode. So this is why when we help someone change or just simply do a different behavior, then if we don't help that client incorporate that behavior into an evolving operating model of how and who they see themselves, their identity, they'll revert back. That's the most powerful force of the human psyche, to revert to our identity, to go back to that default mode. There's always the pull of the old and the fear of the new. Even when you up the ante, add significant success or significant stress, like a major transition, really out of a comfort zone. So we're going to talk more about comfort zones and how to program change, how to create new algorithms. So another part of the answer to why change is difficult is in our brains. Here's an illustration. The hypnotherapist, Dr. Milton Erickson, told a story from his childhood. Whenever it snowed, he would be the first to get up and go to school so he could create a fresh path in the snow. He intentionally created a really circuitous path, zigzags, indirect turns, and he noticed that each person who followed him followed the same path. Until the end of the day, the path was well-worn despite its really circuitous route. Not a single person started a new, more direct route. And he would do this the next time it snowed with increasing diabolical twists and turns. Each person followed that path of least resistance. Not a single person took a straighter or more direct route. This is how neural pathways are laid down in the brain, by early experiences and then repeated until they're etched more deeply. Even if they don't work as well, even if they're circuitous and require way more work. And this is a complex set of algorithms for everything that we do, whatever we think, feel, behave, experience. There are pathways and experiences that get repeated automatically. To think creatively, new neural pathways need to be developed outside the cycle of usual experience. Stimulation for new insight is a circumstance where the brain can't predict what will happen next. This is what we specialize in coaching. The catalyst for insight is a novel stimulus, a question, looking at something in a different way, a new context. We're going to talk about this juncture in particular, when your mind and brain both react to leaving the familiar to engage even just a new way of thinking or feeling or engaging something. The uncertainty of this newness can be read as evidence not to proceed, as intuition saying you made a wrong choice, or a signpost of danger and progress. Now, I mention this because every step into a new or different experience, just simply a different way of thinking or behaving, that will evoke in your client this signal that something is not right. The error detection mechanism in the brain is even involved. This is not what I expected. So that discomfort, even one step into the new or different, that discomfort can be misread as evidence not to proceed or my intuition is telling me this is not the right thing. And that's where we need to help that client understand and reframe the experience as this is an expectable reaction or response to doing something different, to help them frame that uncertainty or that anxiety, not as evidence they're doing something wrong, but as a signpost of being in new territory beyond where they've been before. So this is one of the excellent questions that I had sent in was about how to get someone, how to recognize when someone needs to move into a totally different way of thinking or being, not to carry part of the past forward, but to create something in response to something right now that perhaps is unprecedented in that client's life. So we struggle to embrace change. I mentioned that many of the methods to facilitate change are contrary to how our mind and brain work. Neuroscience, quantum physics, strategic coaching have a lot to teach us about change and resistance to change. So I want to discuss right now, just briefly at least, what I think is the most important variable to determine success for clients: regulating states of mind and managing emotion. Never more important than at a time of change and huge transition all around us, unprecedented times and changes. So let's look at that a little bit more carefully. A state of mind is a mind-body state, like a specific software program that determines how we perceive and then how we process information and how we respond. So a state of mind is a set of particular emotions, memories, models, behavioral patterns. So a key element is helping a client become aware of various states of mind and perhaps focus on what state works best for what purpose. Clients may move from a state of mind where they feel stuck or simply need to regulate that state of mind to being grounded and centered and considering things that they perhaps had not done before. Now, there are a couple of studies that show how important this is. The studies looked at executives and found that the major factor for executive success was self-regulation, managing emotions, and being able to develop a reflective mindset. That was Scientific American Mind and Harvard Business Review. Now, they only measured executives. I think that's true for everyone, and especially I think it's true for our clients in dealing with looking at, understanding, and creating change. So here's an illustration of how a state of mind is like a specific software package. If you take a rat, some of you guys may remember this from college. If you take a rat, put it in a maze, and teach it to get to the cheese, it can go again and again. Now, if you inject that rat with a little bit of amphetamine before you teach it to get to the cheese, you can teach it and it will go again and again. Now, when you take away the amphetamine, the rat can't access in its brain, can't remember how to get to the cheese, and it can, in that maze, literally die of starvation, even though it has in a part of its brain how to get to the cheese. Reinject the amphetamine, it immediately goes to the cheese. State-specific memory, state-dependent learning. So this is an example of two different states of mind without any overlap. It's really an example of something more like extreme success, like post-traumatic stress disorder, where something is cordoned off as a way of protection or even survival. Now, a more common example is you try to think of somebody's name. You know the name, but you can't think of it. It's on the tip of your tongue. You just can't recall it. Then later, in a more relaxed state, suddenly, boom, it comes to mind. So a state of mind is like a mind-body state with a specific software program that determines how we perceive and process information and how we respond. When we are grounded and centered, we have access to all the information in all of our states of mind. And that's exactly what I think is helpful to begin every coaching session with every client, to get grounded and centered, to be able to be fully resonant with that client's experience and full access to your understanding and empathic response and intuition to do that. So once we're tuned into the client, we can receive information in all sorts of ways, not just verbal. We can explore experiences, possibilities, brainstorm, plan. This resonance can creatively transform the experience with our client into new ideas, co-creations beyond where either coach or client may have gone before or alone. So we need to engage all of our experience and be totally grounded and centered and be able then to resonate fully with the client, to stay attuned to their story, to their experience, and to help them develop this self-reflective capacity, and ultimately to develop empathy with themselves. Empathy is not an end in itself. It's simply a better way of listening and helping the client do that, to develop that self-reflective capacity themselves. So most important thing we can do to achieve success is to manage emotions and regulate states of mind. Consider what these people have in common. John Belushi, Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley, Janis Joplin, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Kurt Cobain. They never learned the crucial success strategy of managing their states of mind using drugs, alcohol, or some other substance or process to regulate a state of mind and manage emotions can lead to compromise. So state of mind, then, determines the meaning we attach. When we're grounded and centered, we have access to all the information in all of our states of mind. It's not an altered state. For example, you get to a point of doing something, and it's new and different. You stop yourself, and immediately the old mindset is booted up of, I can't, I don't think I'll be able to. All of the aspects in that time capsule get activated, and it's the same conversation, the same negative self-talk. We'll talk about a really quick way to deal with that, but I'm talking really now more about the process. So how we focus and how we self-regulate is important for us to do to be able then to help our client to engage in that as well. People thought Goliath, and I'll give a case illustration in just a bit. People thought Goliath was too big to hit. David asked, if he's that big, how could I miss? Starbucks founder Howard Schultz didn't ask if people wanted to buy a cup of coffee or a latte, but do you want a concept of community, a third place between home and work? And listen to how Steve Jobs convinced at the time former Pepsi president John Sculley to become CEO of Apple. This was a while ago. They were on a balcony overlooking Central Park in New York City, and Jobs simply asked Sculley, you want to sell sugared water all your life, or you want to change the world? So think about... Here's something that that I ask. I was asked by a buddy of mine who does a Vistage group, a mastermind group for business people, and there were there were two people in her group there were like 18 business owners and CEOs. There were two people who had significant difficulty at their work. There were accidents at both of the places, loss of life, major trauma. And she was mentioning that those two people were not able to get beyond that, and they had spent the last 3 or 4 months of the mastermind group, of the Vistage group, helping them deal with it. And she asked if I could be a guest speaker, do a workshop on stress management and looking at regulating states of mind. And as I listened to them and saw what they did, they each described something that is very commonplace. We're always asking ourselves questions when we wake up, before we even actually hit the floor. What's going to happen today? They were asking themselves questions, and they had each, one for 3 months, one for 4 months, persisted with being preoccupied by the stress, and it was trickling down. One was an owner, one was a CEO. Everybody in the organization had been compromised. So I suggested that they do something very simple. Before they went to bed at night, they write down 3 questions that would put them in a very positive, empowered state of mind. Because they were doing this, they were just asking lousy questions. They were just asking negative questions, wondering what could go wrong. So they did that, and they reported to her a week after they did that, that there was a significant turnaround for them, and they had noticed it beginning in their boardroom and in their organization. So how we establish a frame of mind to begin the day can make a significant difference. And think about when you get up, you stub your toe, and you're going to have a lousy 3 or 4 hours. If you orchestrate a positive framework, it sounds so simple, but it really establishes a mindset and a point of reference. Now, here's an example of using a this is in your outline, and look especially at the outline about regulation, and you'll see this. But let me just kind of explain. A mantra is a cue of focus of physiology, a cue of something that you may simply do to focus on getting grounded and centered. It's an instantaneous thing, and it can be very helpful. Let me give you an example. University of Southern Utah's new coach, Roger Reed, inherited a basketball team that was 217 out of 217 in his division nationwide in free shot percentage. They were cellar dwellers in free shot percentage. So he immediately instituted a different way of practice. He had them, when they were practicing free shots, he had them do a cue of focus of physiology that took 3 to 4 seconds. He suggested that they dribble the ball as a cue to think about a focus phrase that would align the energy field of their brain. He didn't put it in those terms, but he suggested something like relaxed and smooth. And then while they were doing that, to take one deep breath to breathe in relaxation and breathe out any tension. So in that 3 seconds, they dribbled, did the focus phrase, and did the breath of relaxation when they did that. Now, in addition, he would suddenly blow the whistle in practice and have them go to the free shot line, because in a game, you don't get to line up and shoot 30 free throws and count your best. He had them go to the line. If they made both, they got a break. If they didn't, they ran 4 laps. In 2 years, they were number one in their division nationwide. So this is a very simple way of thinking about regulating a state of mind, a cue, a focus, a physiology. Because think about the last time that you got in a negative thought loop, like I can't do it, this is going to work out lousy. Whatever the negative thought loop is, there was some cue or trigger. It may have just been simply doing something different or in a new way, that when you stop yourself, that instant booting up of the time capsule of all the old behavior, the negative self-talk, whatever it is, the doubt, that all gets booted up. When you don't do it, you stay focused in the present. If we have time, I'll give you an illustration from a client I worked with to apply this in a different way. So there are two forces behind all behavior: the need to avoid pain and the desire to gain pleasure. So to understand the motivating force of pain and pleasure, the need to avoid pain is biological. The brain fights against change to avoid pain on a biological basis, or the perception of pain, or anticipation. Trying to create success by creating more pain, unless achieving that success, usually doesn't work. So in any moment, the pleasure of something may feel greater than the pain of not doing it, especially if it's something pleasurable. For example, pleasure of eating a cheesecake right now. It's more enjoyable than the idea of being overweight or out of shape. Overweight's an abstract idea, not the same level of sensory reality as immediate pleasure. So another example, spending money in this moment is a greater pleasure because the anticipation of spending creates a hit of dopamine, the pleasure chemical. So the idea of saving or a greater good later on or the time value of money, that's an abstract idea. Or avoiding debt financially, emotionally, it's an abstract idea, so it makes it harder. So to influence someone, find out what they're already influenced by, what they link pain and pleasure to. If you're not doing something you want or need to do, you link more pain with doing it than not doing it. If you don't have enough money or money you want, somewhere in your unconscious mind, you may link greater pain to having it. With a lack of abundance financially, unconsciously you may think money equals pain. For example, all this effort would take. I think I'm just as comfortable where I am. People will judge me. I'll be ostracized. I'll be lonely at the top. So think about anything that you do. Think about the last thing that you planned to do. And then at the last minute, you procrastinated. You put it off. Consider that there was a signal of some kind of discomfort or anxiety that you instantly booted up an old mindset and all the reasons that made it make sense to not do it. So that process is something that you will again and again have the opportunity to work with a client. Because anytime that anyone stops themselves from doing something this instant, there will be an old mindset booted up, and there will be the sufficient reasons not to proceed, or all the negative things in that time capsule. So let me just tell you briefly the case illustration I had in mind. I think I'm far enough in the outline to catch up. I worked with a woman in London who recognized that she spent much of her time in a kind of disconnected state, that she was that she had trouble being really grounded and centered, and recognized that this prompted her to be in a kind of dread, a kind of anxiety, a kind of worry, and that took away a lot of professional time and energy for her, as well as a good deal of her private life. So what we did then was to look at how she could use a mantra to get grounded and centered. So what she decided to do was to purchase a ring that she would wear for the purpose of touching the ring to use as a cue to get grounded and centered, and then developed a focus phrase to get really present and to then do that again and again, each time with a deep breath when she did it. And she found over time, just the 4 or 5 seconds of taking a deep breath, touching her ring, and focusing immediately on what she wanted to do, and her relaxed and powerful was very, very effective. So it took a lot of work to do this over time, but she got better and better at it and was significantly more effective professionally and personally in doing this. So this is something that we're looking at. Basically, the thing that most often keeps you from getting what you want is the story you tell yourself about why you can't have it. So for any situation, there are three components: state and story, strategy. State is exactly what we're talking about. It's state management, the most important aspect. To choose a mindset and to engage a mindset for exactly what you want to engage. And think about those of you who have worked with clients who have ADD have probably already done this to help them stay focused in a particular way, to self-regulate and stay focused and look at a very systematic approach and also create a way to not get distracted or be diverted, to create an environment that supports that. And so how do you condition yourself to make changes that last? So here are three key elements of this neural conditioning that we're talking about now to create change and make it last. And this is kind of the cheat summary of what we're talking about. One, identify specifically what to change. You get to the point where you feel you have to change something. You have to change it now, that you can change it. So must, can, and will change it. And maybe to feel that not changing it would be more painful than the immediate pain of the change process. So believe that change will ultimately bring pleasure. So here are some questions for this first step. If you don't change your pattern, what will be the consequences? What's the pain associated to a current choice that's now adaptive? What will be the pleasure with changing? Secondly, interrupt the existing pattern. Recognize the cues for the behavior so you can interrupt it immediately. So a pattern has to be interrupted to change neural conditioning and create a different mindset. So here are a couple of questions for this second step. What are the cues or triggers for your automatic pattern? When you interrupt that pattern, how can you cue a new behavior? Three, create new association that empowers you. Remember those two questions, or those three questions that I asked the executives to write. Think of all the things that you gain and the pleasure you'll have from the change. Condition a new empowering association to the same cue. For example, If you're scared to do something, link feeling strong and powerful with that previous phobic stimulus. When you feel and behave differently, the problem dissolves by creating a new story. So here are some questions perhaps for this step. What's the new association to a familiar cue or trigger? What is the change you will bring about? Think of all the things you gain and the pleasure you have with the change. And you guys are very familiar with this. Viktor Frankl wrote a book called A Man's Search for Meaning about his experiences in a Nazi concentration camp during World War II. He was a Jewish psychiatrist in a concentration camp where death was certain. Instead of giving up and accepting his inevitable fate of death, he observed that 1 out of 25 of prisoners somehow managed to survive. So he studied the characteristics of those who survived. What he found was that when the survivors associated, what they associated to made the difference of whether they survived or not. 24 out of every 25 focused on the inevitable and instant death for them. The people who survived developed a reason to survive, to create a meaning for their suffering rather than accepting their fate or wondering why God was allowing them to die. For example, they constructed a reason for surviving so they would tell their story to their children to make certain this kind of suffering would never happen again. They transcended the immediate hopeless situation. It changed the meaning of their suffering to something that would make a difference, to substitute an ultimate pleasure of purpose to transcend the immediate pain of the suffering. They were able to make it through and had a will to live because of their framework. The framework determined the meaning. So this is something that we ultimately are doing with our clients, is to help them frame how they construct their story. Remember, we talked in the first seminar about when someone experiences an inevitable uncertainty or anxiety about taking a new step into the unknown or the unfamiliar. If they frame that as anxiety, then it makes sense to stop because better head for cover, and anxiety is a protection. Or if they frame the experience as opportunity, as challenge, even as excitement, it's a very different framework of how to proceed and how to construct a strategy based on that framework. The framework we use determines the mindset we engage to process and experience. And a mindset of challenge, of opportunity, creates new possibility, and in our brains, it creates new associations, new neural networks, and pathways just by that framework. Think about how instant a framework is. I'm going to tell you the title of a book by a social psychologist whose work I follow and have collaborated with. This is the title of his book, Don't Think of an Elephant. See how quickly that framework can get established. So when your client begins, for example, with, well, the problem with that is, boom, that's why I have requested with every client I work with to get their permission, if I feel that something would be helpful to look at this instant, to interrupt them for us to look at it together. And notice I do that and put it in a collaborative framework so that we're doing this together. I also give them permission to interrupt me because it's something I say doesn't make sense. There's no reason to keep going. So that's an agreement that I have both ways with every client so that we can collaboratively look at something right now, because the framework is so important. Because, and we know this from people who get stuck in therapy, often a reason that people get stuck in therapy is they got their problems down. They began with exploring a problem. That pathway is already in their brain. They explore it further. They know more and more about the problem. But yet, every time you explore a problem, even a sensibly defined solution, 1,000 better solutions later, the pathway is etched a little bit more in their brain every time. So that's why we began, and this is a long version of a response to a really elegant question that was sent in about looking at the framework of now and next with a client, not looking at problems, looking at the choice architecture of this moment, of understanding what and how someone constructs their story to be able to collaboratively engage with them. So here's another way of saying it. We never have to go into history or why or the past. Every algorithm that's important in determining how someone thinks, feels, behaves, engages, every algorithm will be manifest in the coaching relationship with you, in the process, or at times the content. So that's what we focus on, to collaboratively look at how we can be a catalyst to help the client construct a better, a more effective story, one that is more aligned with their needs and ideals and can create and implement success strategy. We're looking at this moment, now and next. So that really is what makes coaching unique to all other professions, all other kinds of help, what other people can do with someone. And there are a lot of very viable things in very different ways, but this is what's unique to coaching. We look at the choice architecture of this moment to help the client construct for them what will be a better and more effective story in whatever area or arena that is for them. So this is about how mindsets frame an account of how we interpret, how we process, what we do. And a quick sidebar here about how powerful mindsets are. And researchers at the Norwegian Institute of Science and Technology recently discovered that the brain creates multiple independent maps while moving ahead in the world. The human brain operates like a Google map. Rather than one big map, the brain makes a whole series of maps to navigate. This is why we need to really understand and help the client understand this process, and how the metaphor that I use of developing the client's story, this is what can help pull it together, make it make sense, to look at what the story is telling us, how we inform and create the story. It's not there until we create it, but a story is a way to understand. Now, remember, I've also mentioned the client does not experience it as a story. It is not a story. This is just the way things are. We're using that metaphor to help us better help the client, in my view. So when a new situation arises, a new map is booted up. And this explains how we have different contexts or frames for different situations, different states of mind. This is where we, I believe, need to understand that and help co-create a continuity, a consistency of that. So this is also part of how we want to facilitate or even catalyze a growth mindset as opposed to a fixed mindset. A growth mindset is based on a belief in change. You believe you can enhance and develop yourself. You become open to accurate information about talents, abilities, about adjusting and growing. Howard Gardner, in his book called Extraordinary Minds, said that exceptional individuals with growth mindsets have, quote, a special talent for identifying their own strengths and weaknesses. This is what we help our clients develop, this self-awareness, this ability to be empathic about themselves, to reflect on and engage this observing capacity. Now, those with a fixed mindset try to make sure they succeed, and a goal may be to prove oneself, classroom, career, relationship. So here are some things you'll hear that may indicate a fixed mindset, which simply means this may be a coaching challenge to help someone look at it in a different way. A fixed mindset, intelligence is something basic and essentially unchangeable. You learn things, but you can't change how intelligent you are. You have fixed traits, so success is about proving you're talented or smart. Problems indicate character flaws. Attempts to repair self-esteem include assigning blame or making excuses. So what we do then is to shift. What can we learn from this? How can you improve in that way? So here's an illustration of the impact of belief and mindset. In a Yale longitudinal study of senior citizens, those who saw aging as negative and compromised actually physically deteriorated more over the 3-year period of study. For example, there was a significant drop in their hearing test scores equivalent to 8 years of normal aging in that 3-year period. Negative feelings about old age can make somebody physically age more quickly in areas of hearing, memory, even cardiovascular status. This mindset reduces life expectancy by an average of 7.5 years in this very well-developed longitudinal study at Yale. So here's how we can simply think about helping our clients ask questions and look at behavior, mind, brain. Begin with the client, where the client is. Help the client learn more about what they already know. Blaise Pascal, remember. Highlight positive attributes, the existing neuronal networks that manifest as natural talents and behaviors or patterns. Don't focus on mistakes. Focus will enhance neural etching, so it should be on useful things. Maybe correct mistaken couplings. Understand and build on existing networks. We listen for something until it doesn't make sense, and then we get curious together, is another way of saying it. Let sleeping dogs and old, unuseful networks lay, or leave it to the therapist. And I'm speaking as a former therapist, even psychoanalyst, so I know that of which I speak. The brain has an intrinsic desire to create novel connections. The client has to recognize, or hopefully recognizes, and takes ownership of experiences. Whatever they think and feel and experience, they create each moment. When we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. So we need to give attention to a new experience or a new way of doing or thinking consistently and repetitively, and encourage the client to develop their own metaphors and connection, their own maps, stories, analogies, metaphors all create maps. So here's a summary of some successful change applications for mentor coaching. Concentrate on new behavior rather than problems in order to create new brain pathways. Identifying, labeling a problem, will not solve it. Co-create new ways of thinking to stimulate brain circuits, to look at an eye on the prize, where you're going, to begin new mental maps. Regulate your state of mind and manage emotions to promote expansiveness, mind and brain, and experience. New insights and adaptations occur through balanced learning, left and right brain, intellectual and emotional. And that's a very limited way of saying it, but it's the entire experience, in other words. Facilitate insight rather than give advice. Both the client and us would rather us give advice because that forecloses exploration. The client is either going to find reasons to agree with it, confirmation bias, or reasons to refute it. And either way, what we know from neuroscience is there's a boomerang effect. They inhabit their original position with more fervor, with more resolve at the end of that, and more strongly believe their facts. So what's the opposite of that? Asking a question, engaging someone to look together. Focus on successes rather than obstacles or non-performance. The power is in the focus. If someone is creating an obstacle, look at that as a creation. It's not a noun, it's a verb. They're creating a way to stop themselves. So let's look at other possibilities. Facilitate new behaviors, guide the development and actualization of new mental maps. Collaboratively conceptualize the mental map, the internal model of the client, in order to facilitate a new level of mastery. Now, in the event, and this will always occur, in the event of diversion to an old feeling or behavior, we may want to redirect to the focus the client agreed on, to ideas and energy in the present moment, and stick with that. Remember, the power is in the focus, and permanent change comes from the consistency of that focus. It has to be repeated in order to be hardwired. Knowledge conveyed passively is inert. Knowledge generated through insight changes the mind and brain. So this is where we began this seminar, that you can't change someone just by giving them a better idea or facts or information or data. That doesn't change people's mind. It hasn't in the centuries since Blaise Pascal, even to the present moment. And finally, it may be helpful to conceptualize the meta map with the client in order to master and internalize the process. This helps create a way of incorporating a new experience as a storyline and part of an evolving identity. Now, this is something that I think is a really important part of what we do with a client, is to help them understand and revise their operating model. Now, I'm not using words like that with a client, but I'm talking with you about how do you help a client understand that what they're doing now and this step of a changed behavior is recognized and incorporated. That feels really exciting to look at it that way, or simply to resonate with the client's experience. I hear your energy when you're framing it in that way and looking at possibility. So we're resonating contingently with every experience with a client, maybe framing it, maybe conceptualizing just from a stutter step away, so that the client really develops that capacity for enhanced empathy with themselves. And remember, empathy is not just about feeling, it's about the appreciation of an entire experience, an entire framework, a set of thoughts, feelings, behaviors, mind, body, spirit, all of that combined into the experience. And when you and the client talk about it together and put it in words, kind of leapfrogging along, step by step, this will help the client establish in a very barely perceptible way, but establish that different model and way of looking at things, way of processing things. You're changing their mind and your brain as you're doing that with them. We've got just a minute or two. I'm going to go off lecture mode if you have any questions or comments. We're in conversation mode. Any clarifications or questions from anything I said? Or anything else you want to add to the hopper of things that you'd like us to discuss? Well, again, I welcome any responses you have. You have my email. I welcome any clarifications or questions. There are a large number of people I know. Not everybody could attend. If you're listening to this recording, feel free to respond in any way or with any question, and I welcome that. I really want to make this as absolutely useful and meaningful for you as possible. So let me know how this lands and what else might be helpful to talk about. So thanks very, very much. And I look forward to hearing from you. Look forward to picking you up right here next time. See you guys. Take good care of yourselves.